For our first session this morning, we want, so far as it is possible in a brief hour, to glance through the book of Psalms to consider the nature of the book, how it is built up, how it came to be written, how it came to be preserved as God's word, what it meant to Israel of old, and what it can mean to us if we read it with a sympathetic and an understanding heart. At the outset, we shall utterly fail to understand the book unless we realise that it was in effect the hymn book of the very first Jewish church. It comprises the songs of praise which they sang in organized worship to God, just as this volume comprises those which we sing in our organized worship. As a result of that, the whole of the book is in lyric verse. That is to say, it is in a verse with a certain regularity of meter which can be set to music. Now, all poetry of any kind is more difficult to understand analytically than normal prose. But on the other hand, it is possible of expressing far better, to far greater degree, the whole spectrum of human emotion. And when poetry becomes lyric, that is to say, when its meter is conformed to the necessities, the requirements of music, it gains additionally in its power of expression, in that the full emotional appeal of the music is added to that of the words, but it becomes even a shade more difficult to read analytically, in that it is still further constrained and, from the point of view of syntax, distorted. It is a great pity, in one respect, that our normal authorized version is divided into those short sections which we term verses. It is a division which did not exist in the very earliest days of the book, which was added for the convenience of those who wished to refer to a particular portion of the Bible. And as a means of reference, it is exceedingly useful. But it can, as we scan the book, break up the whole sense and form. I have here, as an illustration, the volume published just over 40 years ago under the title The Modern Reader's Bible. It is not a new version. It is the ordinary revised version plus a few readings adopted from the margin of the revised version. It is singular only in that it is printed as a modern printer would set up the type for an equivalent book. It is in fact printed as a poem. There, for example, is a specimen page, and it is only when one sees the Psalms or any other portion of Hebrew poetry set out in that way that one can fully appreciate some of the beauty of the structure. Hebrew poetry, fortunately for us, fortunately for all mankind, is of a type which can be much more readily translated than, say, the verse of our own language. Where our own verse has quantity and rhyme, Hebrew has what we might term quantity and correspondence. Now, with the quantity, that is, in Hebrew It is a beat of emphasis rather than a beat of syllables. With that, we are not concerned this morning. For unless we read the Psalms in the Hebrew language, that is of necessity lost to us, much as the meter of English verse is lost when we translate it into another language. But the correspondence of Hebrew can be translated and is present in its full beauty in our own version. Whereas, of course, the rhyme of English verse is equally lost when it is translated into another language. And so, for a few moments, in considering the structure of Hebrew poetry, purely in order that we may appreciate to the full the beauty of the Psalms, we will ignore the matter of measure, the beat of the emphasis. Rather, we will focus entirely upon the correspondence, that portion of poetry which is present in our own version. As an example, we will take a few verses from the 119th Psalm. These particular examples are the simplest form of correspondence in Hebrew rhyme. They consist of couplets, that is, two verses, that is, two lines. And these couplets consist of either a repetition of an idea in slightly different words, or the expression of an idea and its exact opposite, or the expression in two parts of a developing idea. Now that sounds very complicated as one says it, but it's very simple in fact. If you will turn to the 41st verse of the 119th Psalm, you will have there what we term the synonymous correspondence. That is, the statement of the same idea in a slightly different way. There are two lines to this particular verse. Let thy mercies also come unto me, O Lord, even thy salvation according to thy word. There, David is asking for the mercies of God to come unto him and the salvation of God to come unto him. The prayer is identical except that it has brought out the idea in its repetition that the mercy of God is expressed in salvation, and the salvation of God has as its cause the fact that God is mercy. Now, if you will just glance back to the 40th verse, you will have a synthetic arrangement. That is, a couplet of two lines in which a development of idea occurs. Behold, I have longed after thy precepts. Quicken me in thy righteousness. There we have, as it were, a logical development. It is because David has longed after God's precepts, because this burning desire is within his heart, that he is able to pray and able to expect an answer to the prayer that God will make him alive in the very righteousness of God. And finally, the third form of couplet, the antithetic, in the 67th verse. Here the two opposites are expressed. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I observe thy word. There are the two opposites again, the going astray and the observing of God's word. But notice the fact that they are coupled by, shall we say, a logical thread, as are all these couplets. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I observe thy word. I observe it because of thy affliction. The affliction is interposed between the going astray and the observation. Here, buried in a single couplet of verse, lies, as it were, the principle behind that strong exhortation in the Epistle to Hebrews, that the affliction of God is the disciplining of God. And no chastisement for the moment seemeth to be joyous, but rather grievous, yet afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Now this very simple form, the couplet, the two verses, can be and is frequently expanded into triplets, that is, into three lines. And we will take our first examples of these from the 35th Psalm. The first verse of the 35th Psalm is actually a doublet, but it is a doublet of a more complex form. Each line of the doublet consists of a doublet in itself. That is to say, there is a double correspondence in each line and a correspondence between lines. The first line, strive thou, O Lord, with them that strive with me. The strife is identical. It corresponds. But of course, there is in this case a progression of thought. There is a correspondence in one line, and the second line repeats it, but slightly differently. Fight thou against them that fight against me. Now, in the second and third verses which follow, we have a triplet. There are three lines in the Hebrew verse, and the first and third line form a progression, but the second line is a repetition of the first. Take hold of shield and buckler and stand up for mine help. Draw out also the spear and stop the way against them that pursue me. There are the two lines. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. And you will notice that the third line summarizes, as it were, summarizes in personal experience within the heart of David that which the first two lines have repeated figuratively and poetically. In the eighth verse we have another triplet, but in this case it is the second line that is repeated and not the first. It is the inverse of the other. Let destruction come upon him at unawares, and let his neck that he hath hid catch himself. Into that very destruction let him fall. Now, the triplet can become completely synthetic. That is to say, all three lines can express a continuous progression of ideas. The 59th Psalm and the 6th verse is an excellent example of this structure. They are three short lines. They return at evening. They make a noise like a dog. They go round about the city. There is the continuing development of the idea. A triplet which on the hop, which paints a single picture. The next verse, for example, is another triplet, and it says the same thing but using a different figure. Each of these triplets has in itself its own complete figure. The synthetic system can be expanded into a number of lines. In the 19th psalm, for example, we have an 8th line unit. Verses 7 to 10. It has been suggested that this was the preliminary meditation out of which grew the 119th psalm. A little later we shall be considering how ideas grow out of these preliminary musings, and it seems quite probable that is the case. But this is all one unit, and you will notice that there is a progression of ideas which commences with the 7th verse and which finishes with the 10th. The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, yea, than much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the honeycomb. There you have 8 lines, each line in itself a doublet containing 2 ideas. Now these units which we have been considering, these doublets and triplets and so forth, are themselves combined in the book into units which in English poetry we should call a verse. But since we call these reference sections verses, we will call them by the name applied to the Hebrew unit, which is strophe. These groups of units form a pattern which is expressive of the emotions pictured in the poem. The 103rd psalm is an excellent example of a fairly simple structure, yet one which brings out this point. We have not time to read the psalm, but it consists of strophes formed of 5 units, 5 units, 4 units, 4 units, and 5. They are roughly verses in our version. 1 to 5 form 5 units. That is to say, each verse is itself a doublet. 6 to 10 are the second. 11 to 14 are 4. 15 to 18 are 4, and 19 to 22 are 5. Now, in that structure, there is brought out the balance of the idea. The first and the second 5 units are each concerned with the greatness of God. The first and the second 4 units are each concerned with the frailty of man. And the final 5 unit returns to the greatness of God. There is a balance. There is the idea of the pattern of God and the pattern of man set one against the other. And significantly enough, it progresses from God to man and up to God. The very pattern itself of creation and salvation. And the same pattern is continued significantly enough pointing towards creation in the 104th psalm which follows. There we have units of 5 and of 4. 5 for God and 4 for creation. A further example, one of transcendent beauty, well known to you, is the 84th psalm. Here we have smaller and simpler strophes, and here it is more involved in that we have 3 ideas intermeshed one with the other, each associated with its own form. There is firstly A single triplet, four doublets, two doublets, one triplet, and two doublets. So that we have three types of units. 1 by 3, 4 by 2, and 2 by 2. Now the 1 by 3 is the house, is associated with the house of God, the 4 by 2 with the blessing of God, and 2 by 2 with prayer. So that we have the house, blessing, prayer, house, and prayer. And each of those motives is thrown into relief, as it were, by the structure of the verse which expresses it. Of course, these are only simple structures, and in a talk such as this, it is impossible to enter into the more complex ones. For example, if you care to consider them at home, the 111th to the 118th Psalms are all one great anthem. And it is an anthem with a most involved structure, but one which, once it has been seen, brings out afresh to our eyes all of the joy and the praise which was expressed when sung in the temple. It is fortunate for us, and doubtless it was for that reason that God chose it, that the Hebrew language is naturally expressive of verse. The Hebrew sees the world, even abstract events, in concrete pictures. The language is in its form picturesque. That is why there is so much of imagery, so much symbol in the expression, even in their prose. They are already almost blank verse. And this goes back to the very opening of Israel's history as a nation. We know that when Israel crossed the Red Sea, Moses burst spontaneously into verse, the Song of Moses, which is taken up in the last book of the Bible as the Song of the Lamb. As indeed it was the song of the deliverance which came through the Paschal Lamb. At a later period in his history, Moses also expressed himself in verse. In fact, it seems probable that behind many of our psalms lie some of the original songs of Moses, songs which have been modified, but used, shall we say, by David to make larger and more elaborate songs, and used again in their turn by Hezekiah to make a still fuller expression of praise and worship to God. Two of our psalms, which are really two parts of the same psalm, are Psalms 90 and 91. They are the Song of Moses, and we would suggest that there is practically no revision in this case. It would appear from the reading of them that they are, as the title says, as Moses wrote them. The picture is vivid. It is Israel in the wilderness, Israel condemned to wander through rebellion against God. That picture is painted so clearly in this psalm. The third verse, "Thou turnest man to dust and sayest, Return, ye children of men." I must apologize if this seems difficult. I'm reading from the Revised Version because I'm reading from Moulton as a version set in poetry. If you're reading from the Authorized, it will not be greatly different. Here, Moses is not, as it were, expressing an idea of a harsh God. He is expressing the facts as he saw them then. "Thou turnest man to dust." This was the condemnation of God in the wilderness. "Of all which have seen my glory, not one shall enter into the land." And it continues, for example, in the fifth verse. Thou carriest them away as with a flood. They are as asleep. In the morning they are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up. In the evening it is cut down and withereth. For we are consumed in thine anger, and in thy wrath are we troubled. Thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. So this psalm continues. But it changes its beat, as it were, with the beginning of what we call the 91st psalm. It turns the view from Israel rebellious and condemned to perish in the wilderness, condemned, as this psalm says, to at the most 70 years, or maybe if they were young when they left Egypt, 80 years, but eventually they must die, for God has said they shall not enter the land. It turns from that to the shining example of faith, to Joshua, who believed and stood firm, to Joshua, who dwelt, we are told, in the very doorway of the tabernacle. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. And in the fifth verse, Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the reward of the wicked. Joshua had been told he should enter. All these afflictions should not come nigh him. The 70 years should not apply to him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. Although, as we suggest, the Hebrew hymns began with Moses, they certainly found their fullest expression with David. Under Moses, the priests sounded with the trumpet. And excellent as it is, the trumpet is essentially an instrument to be used in moderation and to be used with others in the background. David it was who established the musical courses of the Levites to sing and to play with various instruments. Hence, in the future, in the historical records of Israel which follow, you will find that it expresses the trumpets and the instruments of David. David introduced, shall we say, the orchestra against which the trumpet sounded as a solo instrument. Can we picture, for example, the dramatic events with which the 136th Psalm is associated? It may be that one Sunday morning you have been called upon to read this psalm, and you have found it exceedingly difficult to read. For there is all the time a single line and a repetition, "For his mercy endureth forever." It is very difficult to read that psalm so that it makes sense as reading. It can be a little easier if one realizes what it really is. It is a solo voice set against a full chorus and orchestra. The solo voice is there to recount the mercies of God. The orchestra and the chorus to come crashing in repeatedly with an expression of the continuity of his mercy. But when we remember the occasion on which this was first sung, it becomes still easier to understand and a much greater exhortation and lesson to us. Can we see it in our mind's eye? The solo voice enchanting each of these lines, beginning, "O give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good. All Israel gathered before their new temple. The whole nation gathered together in the forecourt of that temple, giving praise unto God." And then, between each of these lines, the voices, the trumpets, the cymbals, the psalteries and the harps, all coming in a crashing melody, "For his mercy endureth forever." And we are told that as of that chorus swept in, suddenly the whole house blazed with the glory of God, so that the Levites halted and bowed, were unable to minister or to continue by reason of the glory. Once we have read and seen that view, difficult as we may find it to read this psalm, we shall never find it devoid of meaning, and we shall never be able to read it without at least a certain amount of interpretive emotion in our voice and manner. All the glories of the worship of David, which became centered in the temple at Jerusalem, passed away, and Israel turned from God. The temple fell into decay. For periods it was, the entrance was bricked up. But there came a time when a new king sat upon the throne of David. A king after God's own heart, even as was David. And when the temple was reopened and repaired, when all the nation was called again to keep Passover before God, and when once more all the musical arrangements of David were revived, the Levites were once more gathered together, trained to play upon their instruments, instructed to give worship to God. Can we view it through the eyes of a priest? You probably know that the Book of Chronicles is not a mere repetition of the Book of Kings. The Book of Kings is, shall we say, the official narrative of the reigns. The Book of Chronicles is the priestly recounting of that which happened, and it emphasizes so often the priestly view, the view of the man who is centered in giving praise and worship to God. And in the 29th chapter of the second Book of Chronicles, we have, as it were, through a priest's eye, all the joy and the gladness of this revival of the worship of God, this revival of the Book of Psalms in the life and the experience and the expression of Israel. The 25th verse, "And he," Hezekiah, "set the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals and with psalteries and with harps, according to the commandment of David and of Gad the king's seer and Nathan the prophet. For the commandment was of the Lord by his prophet. And the Levites stood with the instruments of David, and the priests with the trumpets. And Hezekiah commanded to offer the burnt offering upon the altar. And when the burnt offering began, the song of the Lord began also, and the trumpets together with the instruments of David, king of Israel. And all the congregation worshipped, and the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded. All this continued until the burnt offering was finished. And when they had made an end of offering, the king and all that were present with him bowed themselves and worshipped. It was, in fact, the scribes of Hezekiah who set themselves to gather together, as it were, much of, shall we say, the exhortational and the liturgical matter of Israel, that which had existed in the days of David and of Solomon, but which had passed away and had become lost or disused. We are told at the end of the book of Proverbs that it was the scribes of Hezekiah who sought them out, who set them in order, and who added unto them some more which were found. It is very probable, in fact almost certain, that it was the scribes of Hezekiah likewise who found the work of Solomon, which has become known to us as Ecclesiastes, and who edited it and published it in a form suitable for his own age, and hence presented us there with one of the problems of the book, the reflections of the days of Hezekiah as well as of those of Solomon. And above all, and possibly we are most grateful in this, they gather together the songs and the hymns of Israel, and made them into five books which have come down to us as the volume of the Book of Psalms. Much of the contents of those five books are of course much earlier than the days of Hezekiah. We have suggested that a basis lies behind very many which originated with Moses. Certainly David was gifted in this way, and David is responsible for very many of those psalms. But Hezekiah and his scribes also added to the book, rounded it off, and, to use a modern term, shall we say, edited and published it. Certainly, the arrangement, the order of them, as we have, is the work of Hezekiah. There are five books. Each one has a special introductory psalm and a special closing one. But the first book and the last book are exceptional in that the first psalm of the first book opens, of course, the whole collection, and the last psalm of the last book closes it. Now, the first book consists of the first 41 psalms. Psalms 3 to 41 are all psalms of David. Psalms 1 and 2 were prefixed by Hezekiah, but were almost certainly, shall we say, a re-editing or a rewriting of the psalms of David. The second book, Psalms 42 to 72, are mainly Psalms of David. They comprise the 42nd to the 72nd, of which Psalms 51 to 71 are all David. You will notice again the Psalms of David have been left together. These first two books are preeminently books of the Psalms of David. But Psalms 42 to 50 have been added in front of that collection of Davidic psalms, And Psalm 72 has been added by Solomon. It is a song of Solomon added to complete the book. It says, significantly enough, the prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are ended. And significantly enough, this second book is preeminently the prayers and petitions of David. The third book of Psalms, numbers 73 to 89, are miscellaneous. There is one psalm by David included in that collection, but mainly they are by Asaph, by the sons of Korah, and by Ethan. The fourth book, 90 to 106, is also miscellaneous. Most of them are anonymous. They do not tell us the author. But one, the 90 and 91, as we have seen, is by Moses, and two of them are by David. The fifth book is the latest of the books. It is one which we would suggest was collected and published by Hezekiah following the great deliverance from the Assyrian invasion. For it is full of Israel relieved, Israel freed from oppression. There is much Davidic material there, but as we shall see a little later, they are where they are concerned. The Psalms of David, not this time left as they were, but greatly modified. There is much of the spirit of Hezekiah to be found in that final book. Now, each of our Psalms in our version has a little heading. But those headings were not there, of course, by the author or composer of the Psalms, but they were very early. Certainly before 300 BC they were there as directions, an instruction, a note on who wrote the psalm and a note on how it was to be sung or when it was to be sung. But it contains a number of technical terms for the instruments of the orchestra, for the parts of the choir who were to sing them. And since Hebrew became a dead language shortly after the days of Hezekiah, and Aramaic became the spoken language in Israel, many of the Jews forgot what those terms meant, and they became difficult to understand. When the Septuagint version, that is, the Hebrew Bible, was translated into Greek by the Jews themselves, which occurred certainly before 200 BC, their efforts to translate these phrases at the beginning of a psalm are evidence that at that period they did not understand them. The key to many of these has been discovered within the last century by an astute Bible student who read his Bible, as we should all read it, critically. He was reading the book of Habakkuk. He was reading it because he did his reading from the Bible Companion, as we do, day by day. And when he came to the third chapter of Habakkuk, he found it was a psalm. And he noticed, as you may have noticed or may not, that it was prefaced with a note as to who wrote it. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet upon Shigionoth. And following it, there was a direction as to how it was to be sung and played to the chief singer on my stringed instrument. Now here is a psalm which isn't joined on to other psalms, and it shows us how these directions were written in. The author, and possibly the occasion of writing, occurs before, but the directions for singing occur after. And if we turn that back into our book of Psalms, we find that much that was a problem has become plain. Let us take an example. If you look at the top of Psalm 88, you will find that is completely contradictory. It says, a psalm of the sons of Korah. And then it goes on to say, it's a maskil of Heman the Ezrahite. But it can't be both. But at the head of our psalms, we have, firstly, the directions concerning the psalm that went before, and then the note as to who wrote the other. And once we have divided those two, and have applied the bit that refers to how or when it was to be sung to the psalm before, instead of the psalm after, everything becomes plain. Psalm 87 is headed as a psalm, the psalm of the sons of Korah. And it finishes with that, because there was no particular direction for instruments in this case or for date. The normal procedure with all our psalms was to precede it with the authorship and the circumstances of composition. Some of the psalms, as we have said, are anonymous. They are not noted. And it follows with liturgical application. Sometimes the type of instrument, sometimes the type of choir, sometimes the time of year to be sung. There are psalms that we are told are to be sung at Passover. There are psalms we are told that are to be sung by a male choir. That in itself is an interesting subject, well worth your while to follow up. Now, we have suggested that Hezekiah took some of the psalms of David and altered them. Now that sounds very much like a higher critical suggestion. And I would not dare to stand here and tell you so if it was my idea. The only reason I stand here and tell you that is because you ought to know it. At least you ought to know that the Psalms of David were taken and altered very much. Because if you have done your daily readings with a critical eye, the Bible will have told you so. Would you care to turn for a moment to the first book of Chronicles and the 16th chapter? The incident is the bringing up of the ark from the house of Obed-Edom by David. And David's heart, as we know, was filled with gratitude and praise for God. So much so that he danced before the ark and won the disapprobation of the daughter of Saul. And in the seventh verse we are told, then on that day did David first ordain to give thanks unto the Lord by the hand of Asaph and his brethren. And there followed in the rest of the chapter a psalm of David, a spontaneous expression of praise to God. And it is spontaneous. Technically, as a poem, there are some minor faults within it. But this psalm reappears in the book of Psalms. But you won't find it in this form. You will find it not only used as portions of other psalms, but you will find, even where it is almost word perfect, you will find it altered. The meter is improved. For example, the verses 8 to 22 in this chapter appear as the first 15 verses of the 105th Psalm. But there are a few minor changes. They're very minor. It's almost exact. But verse 13 here, in this chapter, for example, has a slightly faulty correspondence. the names of Abraham and Jacob come one against the other. And in the 105th Psalm, that has been brought into line. The names are Israel and Jacob. In the 15th verse of this chapter, there is an exhortation to remember. But in the 105th Psalm, the 8th verse of the 105th Psalm, that exhortation is strengthened, and it is made a basis of hope for the future. He hath remembered. Now, when we proceed beyond the 22nd verse of this psalm, we proceed into two other psalms. Verses 23 to 33 appear as the first 13 verses of Psalm 96. But here, if you will look, there are many more and more fundamental changes. Yet the spirit is the same. The 34th verse of this psalm is the first verse of the 106th psalm. And the 35th and 36th verses are verses 47 and 48 of Psalm 106. Again, we have not time to continue and elaborate on this. There are many places in the book of Psalms where the hand of Hezekiah can be traced, and it is a fascinating study to read through the book with the history of Israel in mind. The fact is that a number of men, many men, have contributed to the book of Psalms, but three have been preeminently responsible for shaping it. They are Moses, David, and Hezekiah. And those men all had much in common. They were all men well-pleasing to God. They were all men who ruled God's people for God. And they were all men who were faced with an obstinate and rebellious people. Hence, they were all moved, as it were, with the same emotions. They all faced the same griefs and the same aggravations, and were all comforted with the same joy. In fact, we might say that the poems in the book of Psalms have passed through a triple filter, each of these men, as it were, modifying and bringing them into the same pattern, which is one reason why the whole book is such a unity, such an expression of the same feeling from beginning to end. But Jesus was, in effect, all of these three men. He was the prophet like unto Moses. In right words. But if that had happened, those words would not have been understood. If all that Jesus came to tell us could have been told by a voice speaking from the heavens and a stenographer taking them down, then God would have been very cruel to send his son to do it. It is because the revelation in Jesus could not come in any other way that Jesus differs from all other sources of information. It is because God does not change, and because only a man who is holy in life and thought may approach unto God, that these psalms express that which is eternal in all ages concerning the relationship between God and man. They are preeminently expressions of the life of Jesus, because Jesus was preeminently the one who loved and lived God,
But insofar as Christ can live in us, they can and should become equally an expression of our life and our experience. Let us take an example of a psalm which we all consider quite rightly to be prophetic. The second psalm. If we cast our mind back over the history of David's life, it seems most probable that David first sang this psalm on the occasion of his victory over Zobah and Damascus in Federation. The circumstances would fit. But it seems equally certain that Hezekiah sang it and possibly modified it when he received his great deliverance from Sennacherib. Again, the circumstances fit, and a different man and a different age can sing exactly the same song. But in the fourth chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, we are told that Peter used the same word, used it of his day, because the circumstances fitted. He said, surely the nations and the kings of the earth with Pontius Pilate have taken counsel together to destroy thy holy child Jesus. But God hath raised him from the dead. The Lord shall laugh, he shall have them in derision. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. We look, and with good reason, for a time when we shall again take up the words of the same psalm, when Jesus is returned to this earth, and when all human pride and arrogance and rebellion have been abased before. But even then we shall be but reliving this. For beyond all doubt, the greatest and the final fulfillment of this, in fact, the only one which will fulfill it in every detail, is future by more than 1,000 years. Only at the end of the millennium, only then will the kings of the earth be bound by his court and in confederation together saying, let us burst their bonds asunder and cast away his cords from us. And only then, in the fullness of time, when God shall become all and in all, will this song be sung with its fullest and its deepest meaning. Thus also, we can face the problem, shall we say, for example, presented to us in the 13th chapter of John's Gospel. If for a moment you will put your thumb in the 41st Psalm and the 13th chapter of John's Gospel, you will see the problem. Jesus himself is the speaker. He is seated around the table in the upper room with his disciples. He has told them that one should betray him. And in the 18th verse he says, I speak not of you all, I know whom I have chosen, but that the scripture may be fulfilled, he that eateth my bread lifteth up his heel against me. Now that is a direct quotation from the 41st Psalm. Jesus was experiencing all that David experienced when Ahithophel turned against him and almost worked his ruin. The 9th verse of that psalm, yea, mine own familiar friend in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. Now we are told in the epistle to Hebrews that for the joy that was set before him, Jesus endured the cross and despised the shame. And that joy was, of course, the salvation of mankind. It was that for which Jesus suffered. It was with that in mind, as Isaiah spoke, he shall see of his seed and shall be satisfied. But not so, David. Thou, O Lord, have mercy upon me and raise me up that I may requite them. That was David's option in recovering from this illness. And also, of course, in verse 4, David was a man who sinned. I said, O Lord, have mercy upon me, heal my soul, for I have sinned against. It is only when we turn our eyes away from the obvious background of the psalm that we find problems here. Many of the problems that are found are problems of our own seeking or of others' seeking. The critics, for example, are so overcome by the advanced presentation of God, of which we shall be hearing later in this book, it would entirely destroy all their theories of natural religion if this book were early, if much of it went back to the days of Moses, even back to the days of David. And it is for that reason that they look for difficulties. Only by finding difficulties can they possibly continue to cling to all that fabric of human wisdom which they value so highly. So far as we are concerned, if we read the book as it is, if we limit our views of inspiration to that which the Bible claims for itself, if instead of making up our mind what God is like and how he would speak, which often merely means how we would speak if we were in God's place, and it is because we are not capable of taking that responsibility that we are not now there. It is because we are weak and human and erring that we are in need of salvation, in need of the covering cloak of Christ's righteousness. If only we will decide that we will put on one side all the products of our own cleverness, that we will not decide for God how he will think or how he will act, but rather we will read God's word. We will note all points in which it differs from all human work, and we will say, there is the nature and the mode of inspiration. That which is different from all other books is that which constitutes divine inspiration.